first time in California history and the second time in United States history, men and men and women who have loved each other for decades can finally formalize that love, the life they've had together, and their future in the form of marriage.
Late last month, they began performing gay marriages in the state of California. Some people think that this does not bode well for the issue of gay marriage in the United States in general. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Robert George joins us for the first half of this hour to talk about two issues, gay marriage in California and the right to life as the foundation for all human rights. Then a little later in this hour, Dr. Ken Cherb will join us. We'll talk about American civil religion coming off of our holiday weekend, the Independence Day weekend. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Robert George is professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. He's co-author of the books Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, and The Meaning of Marriage. Robert, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
Well, with the story coming out of California about gay marriage and the gay marriages being performed there, a lot of people are saying, look, this is inevitable. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect you. Let's live and let live. How do you respond?
There are three things that need to be said in response to that. Let's go through them carefully. The first thing we should recognize is the institution of marriage is very much at stake in the debate over what the meaning of marriage is. Marriage will mean one thing in this culture if it's defined as the union of any two people irrespective of sexes. It will mean another thing if it means what is historically meant, which is the union, the conjugal union of a man and a woman. So number one, if we remove, as a matter of law, the requirement of sexual bodily complementarity from the meaning, the definition of marriage, we will at the same time have removed any logical basis. Let me reiterate that. Any logical basis, that is, any basis in principle for restricting marriage to two and only two people. Once the requirement of sexual complementarity is removed, then there's no reason in principle at all why marriage should be the union of two people and not three people or five people. So polygamy, and not simply polygamy but polyamory, would be logically something that could be requested based on the law's recognition of same-sex partnerships. Now, people sometimes say, well, but nobody's asking for polyamory. Nobody's asking for polygamy. The trouble with that argument is it's just plain false. People are asking for those things, and they're asking for those things because they recognize that once bodily complementarity is removed from the definition of marriage, there are no logical reasons why you should stop short of there. Most people understand that marriage is two and only two people. But people who make the mistake of thinking that marriage is a purely emotional union, if people fall for the slogan, love makes a family, then sure, two people of the same sex can love each other, but so can three people and five people married together or joined together in a sexual partnership. So that's number one. Number two, the meaning of marriage in our culture really does depend on what the law says it is. The law is a teacher. It's a profound teacher. It will teach one thing if it adopts the revisionist position and redefines marriage as the union of any two people, and it'll teach something different if it maintains the traditional understanding of marriage. This is what will be taught to our children and to our grandchildren, both formally in schools and other institutions, and informally. What's at stake for all of us, and not just for people who are contemplating entering into same-sex unions. What's at stake for all of us is the meaning of marriage in our culture and what will be taught to our children. Then the third point, very, very important one for religious people, whether you're a Catholic, an evangelical Protestant, an observant Jew, a member of any other faith, and that is the minute our experience shows, both in Massachusetts and in foreign jurisdictions where same-sex unions have been legalized and recognized as marriages, the moment we get legal recognition of same-sex unions, then anti-discrimination laws already on the books are used as cudgels to whip dissenting persons and institutions into line. So those institutions, Catholic institutions, Protestant Jewish institutions, Muslim institutions that wish to honor their own moral understanding of marriage will not be allowed to do so, except in the narrowest of circumstances. If they try to do so by, for example, ensuring that teachers in religious schools or in other social service institutions that are sponsored by religions observe the church's or religious institutions' requirements about morality, they will be subject to lawsuits under anti-discrimination laws to force those religious institutions to recognize same-sex unions. So religious liberty, the liberty of the church, the liberty of the Orthodox Jewish community, the liberty of other religious communities, is imperiled by this. It doesn't just affect a couple of people who may be living next door to you. It affects all of us.
Have we reached the point of no return? I mean, some might say Massachusetts is, an oddity, but then we have other states that have begun to compromise on this issue. But California, for heaven's sakes, California openly recognizing and permitting the performance of gay marriages by the name marriage, some would say, all right, the floodgates are open and we can't close them.
That may be true. We'll know in November. If the people of California do what they did only 7 or 8 years ago, when in an initiative, a referendum by something like a 60-40 margin, opted to retain the traditional definition and understanding of marriage as the conjugal union of a man and a woman. If the people of California do that again, then that will be a trendsetter and that will be a game changer. And I think the momentum across the country will be very much in favor of conjugal marriage and against the redefinition of marriage. If, on the other hand, the people of California don't do that, if they fail to stand up against the Supreme Court of the state, which is imposed by judicial fiat, a mere vote of 4-3, same-sex marriage on the state, then I think it will be hard to stop same-sex marriage from spreading outside of California across the country. Unlike Massachusetts, where there is a law that forbids Massachusetts from forbids people from contracting marriages in Massachusetts, which would not be permitted in their home states, so outsiders can't come into Massachusetts, contract a marriage, and go back to their home state and ask for it to be recognized. Unlike the situation in Massachusetts, California doesn't have any such law. So if this Supreme Court ruling of the state of California is permitted to stand, what you will have is what we're seeing already, and that is out-of-staters coming into California, contracting same-sex marriages, and then going back and demanding that their home states recognize those under the guarantee of full faith and credit of the federal Constitution. And I wouldn't be surprised if, in short order, the federal courts came in and forced other states, New Mexico, Missouri, Mississippi, Massachusetts, West Virginia, I'm sorry, not Massachusetts, which already has it, but Pennsylvania, West Virginia, any of these states, I wouldn't be surprised to see federal courts forcing states to recognize out-of-state same-sex marriages. So an awful lot depends, everything depends, on what happens in California.
Do you think that it's been part of the strategy from the beginning, with the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution in view, on the part of those who have been pushing for full legitimacy and gay marriage?
Yes.
Do you think that they will succeed?
I think if the people of California do not resist the imposition of same-sex marriage on them, if this referendum to amend the Constitution of California to preserve conjugal marriage fails, then I think that it's likely that they will succeed in persuading federal courts to impose same-sex marriage nationwide.
When you hear a politician or an individual citizen, for that matter, say, I'm opposed to gay marriage, but same-sex unions, I think we ought to have a legal entity to accommodate same-sex unions, what do you think, Dr. George?
I think that any legal recognition of same-sex unions will tend over time, and probably in a fairly short amount of time, to undermine the institution of marriage. I think counterfeit marriages will only undermine the institution of marriage, and I think that that's really the record in countries that have experimented with this. Now, those were mainly in European countries where marriage was eroding as a cultural institution anyway, so it's a little bit difficult to judge from the data. But I think the best writer on this is Stanley Kurtz, who writes for National Review, is an anthropologist, Harvard-trained anthropologist, who's done some very interesting examining of the data and drawn that conclusion, which is that marriage does tend to erode still further when you have legal recognition of same-sex partnerships. But for those states that do opt for same-sex partnerships, it seems to me it's absolutely crucial that domestic partnerships not be predicated on recognition by the state of sexual relations. In other words, if we're going to have domestic partnership schemes, and if they're not simply to be marriage by another name, then eligibility for those domestic partnerships should be available even to people who are not in sexual partnerships and who could not lawfully be in sexual partnerships. For example, elderly sisters who are living together. They would have the same needs as a same-sex pair who are in a sexual relationship, the needs to visit each other in the hospital and to get insurance coverage and so forth. If we're really talking about meeting people's needs and not about putting the stamp of public approval on sodomitical sexual relationships, then there's no reason for excluding those elderly sisters, despite the fact that under the incest laws, they would not be permitted to be in a sexual partnership. The difference between recognizing a same-sex union as, in effect, a marriage and not doing that really comes down to whether the state predicates the benefits and immunities of the domestic partnership on the presupposition or the existence of a sexual relationship between the domestic partners. It seems to me the critical thing is to make sure that states don't do that.
Robert George is our guest. We're talking with him about gay marriage in California in just a moment. The right to life is the foundation for all other human rights. He's professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University, co-author of the book, The Meaning of Marriage, An Embryo, A Defense of Human Life.
Sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Issues Etc., Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Thanks for your support of Issues Etc.
Contending for the truth in an age of anti-truth, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, look for the sponsors section at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues Etc. listener comment line. 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues Etc. comment line. 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Robert George is our guest. Talking about the issue of the right to life as the foundation for all human rights. We tend to think of human rights, maybe this is wrong, as individual things that can be pulled out, put back in, perhaps interchangeable with one another. Maybe some of them are dispensable. When the founding fathers said that they had self-evident truths, certain inalienable rights, among them life, what did they mean? Robert George is professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. George, when they said that among these self-evident truths and inalienable rights is life, and they began that way, what did they mean to say?
They meant that there's something very special about a human being, that a human being has a certain quality that calls out, demands, as a matter of rationality, respect, that a human being must never be treated simply as an object or a thing or a mere means to other ends, that a human being must be treated as an end in himself. And by a human being, they did not mean some kind of a consciousness inhabiting a body. They meant the unified whole, a human being that is both conscious and alive, that has a bodily life, a biological life. And the life of that human being is the first and foundational right. That's the first thing that has to be protected. No other right could exist. The right to liberty couldn't exist without the right to life. The right to the pursuit of happiness couldn't exist without the right to life. And notice that the Declaration offers these as a non-exhaustive set. It doesn't say, here are the three rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. It says that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There are more, but all of them are predicated on respect for the life of the human being.
Some might argue, well, they certainly could not have had the abortion culture, Roe v. Wade, any of the laws and regulations that have grown up around abortion, euthanasia, all the life issues in mind when they said these things. These were men thinking of in much simpler terms about the word life. What do you think?
I think that's wrong. One of the greatest of the founders, probably the greatest lawyer, legal thinker, among the founding generation and the generation coming just afterward, was James Wilson, the great jurist James Wilson. And Wilson remarked in his writings that we protect the right to life from the earliest stirrings in the womb, from the earliest stirrings in the womb. In other words, what he was saying, he didn't have, of course, our contemporary knowledge of human embryology. We have that advantage now. We know that life, the life of a human being begins at the conception of the human being, the fertilization stage. But he's saying that whenever we've got a human life, even in the womb, that the law casts its protections and must cast its protections over that human being, over that individual. He was rejecting quite explicitly the idea that our rights only kick in at a later stage, at birth or self-consciousness or any of the other so-called marker events that that some people who favor liberal abortion laws would propose to us. No, from the moment we've got life in the womb, Wilson said, the law casts its mantle of protection around that life.
So when we think about the corpus of rights that were in view for the founding fathers and the framers of the Declaration, are we thinking about, as we would call it now, kind of the individual rights? Can we atomize these rights where some can be pulled off the shelf, others can be put on, they can be put in any particular order you want them to come? How were they thinking about rights as a corpus?
Well, they certainly did believe in something that we could call individual rights. That is, every human being is an end and not just a means to other ends. This is the basis on which they would reject and we should reject the philosophy of utilitarianism, the philosophy that's infamously promoted by my Princeton colleague Peter Singer, the idea that you can sacrifice one person for the sake of a larger whole. You could kill one person or kill a person at a very early stage of development or something for a larger or greater good. They reject that because they believe in the dignity of the person, the dignity of the individual human being. All of us have a fundamental right to life. Now, at the same time, they did not have an atomistic view of rights because they understood that among the interests of the human being was our interest in the common good, that all of us are served by the common good, all of us have responsibilities to the common good. So we shouldn't believe in rights without responsibilities. They're responsibilities too. Each of us has rights, but each of us has responsibilities to others. Each of us has responsibilities to the common good. So we would be abusing our rights, engaging in what the founders called license, and distinguished from liberty. License is a bad thing. That means just pursuing your own interest or your own desires without regard for the common good. They rejected the idea of license. We should reject the idea of license. We should reject the idea that all there are rights and no responsibilities. The correct view does honor the individual person, but recognizes that the person has rights, but also responsibilities.
It's very common to hear, Dr. George, our lawmakers and individual citizens say something like, well, on the issue of abortion, it's a deeply moral issue. Therefore, they conclude, the state should not be able to, and certainly should not, and under any circumstances, dictate to an individual how to make up their mind on the issue of abortion.
I wish I could say that that was a bad argument. I have to say it's a hopelessly bad argument. It's the worst kind of argument you could make. Someone once said that far from the law not being able to legislate morality, morality is the only thing that the law can legislate. When we take a stand against cold-blooded murder, when we embody in our law a rule against homicide, when we embody in our law a rule against rape or theft, when we embody in our law, as the 13th Amendment of our Constitution does, the rejection of slavery, we embrace a moral judgment. We make a profound moral judgment that many people throughout history, most civilizations, have not made. Most civilizations have left it up to individuals whether they enslave others. If they have the power to do it, they've been permitted to do it. We reject that. Why? On moral grounds. That the human being has dignity and should never be made a mere chattel, a mere object, a mere thing. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, there was a contradiction in the American founding, because while our founders proclaimed that principle, some of them, including the man who wrote those words, Thomas Jefferson, owned slaves and embraced slavery. Jefferson knew it was wrong, but he still lived with it. He still owned slaves. He didn't even, unlike George Washington, he didn't even free his slaves after his death. But throughout our history, we have appealed to the principle that Jefferson proclaimed, that the founders endorsed, to overcome slavery. And when we did that by a moral argument that was advanced by religious people, what we would today call in many cases evangelicals. Some people would call fundamentalists, who insisted that the law embrace a moral position, the moral position that slavery is wrong. And of course, their critics said, you shouldn't be imposing your morality on other people. You shouldn't be telling us folks down here in the South that we can't have slavery. You're interfering with our rights. You're taking away our property. You should hold your moral opinions and your religious opinions in private and not try to enact them in law. But fortunately, our country didn't buy that argument. At great cost in blood and treasure, we did the right thing. We imposed good morality to abolish the evil of slavery.
Well, having corrected that legal and philosophical inconsistency, as you point out, at great cost, we have since, at least legally, since Roe v. Wade, been living with another remarkable historic inconsistency with legalized abortion on demand. How is that inconsistency possibly corrected, Dr. George? About a minute and a half.
Well, it's got to be corrected the way that the inconsistency over slavery was corrected. And by that I mean, and I hope and pray, not a civil war. I trust that that will not be the way we do it. Rather, we should do it by appealing with civility, in love, and in a loving spirit to our fellow citizens on the other side who don't see it clearly, just as so many of our fellow citizens 150 years ago could not see the issue of slavery clearly. They didn't see the dignity of the black man, the black woman. We need to appeal to people today on behalf of the child in the womb, the child that they themselves at some level know is there. They've seen the sonogram pictures. Any young parents today will have as their first baby shots the pictures of the child in the womb taken by sonography. The grandparents' first pictures of the new baby, the new grandchild, will be pictures of the child in the womb, maybe sucking its thumb, making facial gestures or expressions. So they know that we've got a baby in there. And we need to bring people around with love, with civility, but by vigorous argument and attention, bring people around to understanding the great truth, a truth that's got to be embodied in our law for our law to be just. Our law, our 14th Amendment, says that every single person, doesn't even say just citizens, it says every single person is entitled to the equal protection of the laws. Person just means human being. And we shouldn't discriminate against human beings based on race or sex or ethnicity, but neither should we discriminate against them based on age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency.
Robert George is professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. He's co-author of the books Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, and The Meaning of Marriage. Dr. George, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
They said self-evident. Maybe all we need to do is point out in law and argument, wherever we can, the self-evident truth that what we are dealing with and protecting here is, in fact, life itself. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be right back to talk about American civil religion.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
On behalf of the staff of Issues, Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,500 who signed the online petition to bring Issues, Etc. back. Sydney Schwartz, David Oberdeek, Mark Strobel, Lynn Fredrickson, Carolyn Ziegler, Aaron Wolf, Courtney Kuntz, Dwight Siewert, Pastor Dustin Anderson, and David Nethery. Thanks for your support.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues, Etc. listener comment line. 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues, Etc. comment line. 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Sometimes God's blessings really get your attention. Janelle Perry and her husband Robert were blessed with identical triplets. Here's the unusual part. She conceived them naturally and is a 47-year-old grandmother of two. This latest addition gives them a total of 8 children. Janelle and Robert sold all their baby things last year after failing to conceive. In November, their 4-year-old daughter, Rebecca, told her mom she had 3 babies in her tummy, one for her and each of her parents. Janelle told her there are no babies in there. Then, the following month, she found out she was pregnant. The Perrys feel blessed, but are now of the opinion their birthing days are behind them. They will be followed by full and undoubtedly busy days raising their 4 young children.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.